From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, as a candidate, Donald Trump called for a total Muslim ban. Now that he's president, the courts won't let him forget it. And as the White House fights to protect the travel ban, the immigration story of our vice president, Mike Pence. It's Friday, March 17th.
We have seen the devastation from 9/11 to Boston to San Bernardino. Hundreds upon hundreds of people from outside our country have been convicted of terrorism-related offenses.
In Nashville, Tennessee this week, President Trump laid out a familiar case for his travel ban.
For this reason, I issued an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration from places where it cannot safely occur.
But then a development.
But let me give you the bad news. We don't like bad news, right? I don't want to hear. And I'll turn it into good. But let me give you the bad, the sad news. Moments ago, I learned that a district judge in Hawaii,
a judge in the Ninth Circuit Court,
a judge has just blocked our executive order on travel and refugees coming into our country from certain countries.
It was the second time, that Donald Trump issued a ban on travel from predominantly Muslim countries, the second time that a federal court blocked the ban, and the second time that a judge gave this explanation for the decision.
The basic idea was that President Trump and his allies and supporters have said so many things about wanting to bar Muslims that even a revised and on its face neutral travel ban order is animated by hostility to Muslims and religious discrimination.
Adam Liptak writes about the law for the New York Times.
So what you have on the one hand is a piece of paper that on its face looks fine, that the judges say, if this is all I knew, this would be fine. But because of all the statements and during the campaign and afterwards, the courts look behind what's on the face of the piece of paper to find religious discrimination.
Are the judges looking at any language in particular from the president, a comment or a speech or a tweet?
Give me one sec.
I'm imagining this is the sound of a New York Times legal reporter leafing through a court record.
I know what I want to get to. I just want to get it exactly right. So the statement they really focus on is a press release from the campaign, which is still up on the Trump site.
It's still on the Trump website.
Yeah, it says this. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown
of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
You know, that's fairly categorical, and it's a little hard to ignore, even as the administration first put out what courts found to be a quite overbroad travel ban. Then they revised it and stripped out all of the stuff on its face talking about religion. But these statements still come back to haunt the Trump administration.
So that press release, which, as I recall, was issued pretty early on in the campaign, essentially taints the actions today.
Yes, that's what these courts are finding.
The court is raising the idea that that press release is religiously discriminatory, that that was the aim of that original campaign language. But what we're talking about here is an immigration issue in the law. So is this case about religious discrimination or immigration?
Very good question. And depending on what box you put it in, you might get a different answer. Hmm. So the courts have said, if we're talking about immigration, if we're talking about national security, we don't look behind the face of the official action. We take the government at its word, and if the policy is constitutional on its face, that's good enough for us. In the religion context, the courts are more probing. They want to know whether there's a secret motive, whether there's an attempt to discriminate against religious groups, even if the face of the official action is neutral.
So there's greater scrutiny applied when religious discrimination is at play, or there's a suspicion it's at play.
Exactly right, yes.
The comment that they're seizing on is from the campaign, But I wonder why that is. Is it because he's stopped talking like that since he became president? Or is there something legally different about that language and the language he's used since November 8th?
He's focused more on countries, on territories. He's not talking about Muslim bans publicly. He has talked in connection with the first executive order about wanting to favor Christians.
Persecuted Christians, we've talked about this overseas. Right. The refugee changes you're looking to make, as it relates to persecuted Christians, do you see them as kind of a priority here?
Yes, you do. Yes, they've been horribly treated.
Which is, of course, a sort of religious discrimination. His surrogates, notably Rudy Giuliani.
I want to ask you about this ban and the protest. Does the ban have anything to do with religion? How did the president decide the seven countries? I understand the permanent ban on the refugees.
Okay.
Talk to me.
I'll tell you the whole history of it. So right. When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up. He said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally.
So there's a watered down version of this that survived after the campaign.
All right, but Adam, is there a legal difference?
A legal difference between what a candidate says and what a government official
right.
says? Yeah, I think there is. The government certainly argues that. In its brief, it says, and this makes some sense to me, candidates are not government actors.
Right.
Statements of what they might attempt to achieve if elected, which are often simplified and imprecise.
These people are killing the world.
Are not official acts.
Are killing the world.
They generally are made without the benefit of advice from as yet unformed administrations.
I mean, there's something going on. There's some nastiness, there's some meanness there. There's something going on in the mosques and other places. And we have to at least say there's a problem so we can solve it.
And cannot bind elected officials who later conclude that a different course is warranted.
When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats.
Now that two courts have ruled that this travel ban is legally dubious because of the way that the president has talked about this issue, do we now think that Donald Trump's words will be used against anything he does on immigration in the courts?
I do suspect that. I think that President Trump is being treated differently from other presidents.
Wow. What do you mean?
I think his campaign was so unusual, so heated, so unconventional that courts may not be giving him the deference that other presidents have received.
So given all of this, all the headache that Trump's comments are causing him on this issue, he goes in front of a large crowd on live television Wednesday night.
The order he blocked was a watered-down version of the first order.
It feels like even in talking about this case now, he keeps saying things that seem to build the case against this executive order.
That was also blocked by another judge and should have never been blocked to start with.
And not necessarily in a good way for him.
If I were a lawyer, I would not want this guy for my client. He's constantly hurting his own case, and I just can't imagine what it's like to sit down in the Oval Office and give him legal advice.
Just to be clear, and especially if you're one of those lawyers trying to give him advice, what about the way Donald Trump described this as a watered-down version of the last one could be used against him?
Well, I mean, the idea was this is a clean break.
Right.
We've gotten some judicial pushback. We've gotten a judicial critique. We're going to address that stuff, and we're going to do this right. We're going to, you know, turn sharp corners and make this legally good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then Trump goes out and says,
this new order was tailored to the dictates of the Ninth Circuit's, in my opinion, flawed ruling.
I'm trying to get away with what I can. This is a watered-down version of what I tried to achieve the first time. And then there was a statement also from Trump that he wishes they just appealed the first one, which has also got to have his lawyers steaming a little bit.
Adam, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Always great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
We'll be right back. In 1923, Richard Michael Cawley fled Ireland.
Richard Cawley was a young man who grew up in rural Ireland in a tiny, tiny little farm country town called Dewcastle.
Escaping the poverty and violence of a country at war with itself.
The Irish were embroiled in a civil war over their independence from Britain. And Richard Cawley was caught up in it. He wanted to come to America. I think he just wanted to get out.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg has been tracing Mr. Cawley's story.
At the end of March 1923, he was 20 years old. He got on a Cunard steamship line called the SS Andania, a very plain, kind of sturdy ship, and it pulls into New York Harbor on April 11th, 1923, and thus does Richard Cawley begin his new life in America.
Over 12 million men, women, and children passed this way.
Richard arrived amid a rising anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic sentiment in America. The federal government had just passed a restrictive immigration law.
It's not a good time to be an immigrant in the United States. Richard Michael Cawley winds up settling in Chicago. His uncle has a farm in Illinois outside Chicago, and he holds his job as a streetcar driver and then a bus driver for 40 years. He has children. His children marry and have children. You know, in short, he becomes a very typical Irish-American immigrant.
So, Cheryl, why do we care about Richard Michael Cawley?
Well, Michael, you might not care about him at all if it were not for this one tiny little fact. Richard Michael Cawley's grandson and namesake is Michael Richard Pence, the Vice President of the United States.
Grandpa loved his grandkids, so...
Grandpa paid a lot of attention to him. He was the youngest. He was the littlest then.
Nancy Pence Frisch is the Vice President's mother. Gregory Pence is his brother. They spoke to me from Gregory's home in Indiana.
He taught Michael some Irish one summer when we were on vacation.
The grandfather was fun. He was a true Irishman.
He loved to sing songs.
What kind of songs did he sing?
Irish songs, all the old Irish songs. Oh, Take Me Back Home, Kathleen. What's our favorite song of all? When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
Eyes are smiling, sure it is like a morning spring.
Danny Boy, and just I have books and books of Irish music that he brought home. But my father's love was to dance. He loved to dance.
And Mike Pence, you know how kids are. He apparently does a really mean imitation of his grandfather's brogue. All the Pences can do it.
Have you heard it?
I have never heard it.
Well, I'd be more than happy to help you out now, Michael. Well, I'll talk the whole time in my brogue, if you like.
That's very...
The one thing about the Irish is they take 10 words to say what something other people say in two. I mean, it's just they go on and on and on, and they wear you out to the point you just can't stand it anymore. Yeah, he had quite a brogue. He really did.
Can the vice president do as good an impression as...
Absolutely.
You too?
My brother Michael does phenomenal impressions of people. That's when he first started exhibiting his nature. Those who have kissed the Blarney Stone and passed it on. That's a little bit of the nature. And Michael certainly got that. You know, talkers and, the ability to tell a story. Grandpa definitely was that way, and Michael's the same way.
It's clearly a deep part of them.
How has that personal connection to immigration influenced the way that Mike Pence has dealt with immigration?
You know, I think it poses, in a way, kind of an internal conflict for Mike Pence. Hmm. If you think about who Mike Pence is as a politician, he's a true conservative. He's what I would call a principled conservative. He's very much on the right. And so as he comes of age as a member of Congress, I was very struck by how he wrestled with the question of illegal immigration. You might remember, Michael, back when George W. Bush was president, in 2006, President Bush was pushing for Republicans to tackle the issue of immigration. And there were roughly 11 million illegal immigrants in the country at that time. And Mike Pence comes at it from the prism of his grandfather. He's trying to wrestle with how can we give them a path to citizenship? And he comes up with this plan, which is the 11 million immigrants are going to, quote, self-deport, and they are going to go back to their home countries, and really quick, they're going to come through these Ellis Island-like processing centers in their home countries.
This is quite an elaborate plan.
Yes. And so the idea is that they're going to go home and get right back to the United States and be matched up as guest workers with a possible path to citizenship. And conservatives are just laughing at this, and they are ridiculing him for promoting amnesty.
Interesting. So this was considered too moderate or even too liberal a plan for the right, of which Mike Pence has always been considered a member.
And absolutely. And so he goes to the border, on a trip to the border, and he's asked, what is an Indiana congressman interested in border security?
What's the answer?
April 11th, 1923. The date of the arrival of the SS Andania, the ship that carried his grandfather.
He just laid that out.
He just laid that out. And he also says in speeches that, you know, basically he's issuing also a warning to conservatives that we better hold up the ideals of the Statue of Liberty if we want voters not to abandon us. But Mike Pence clearly is wrestling with this, because in 2006, the same year as he proposes this kind of convoluted plan that doesn't go anywhere, he also puts his weight behind legislation that results in the construction of 700 miles of fencing along the border with Mexico. Now, this is a full decade before he's met Donald Trump and before Donald Trump has promoted his own idea of a border wall. And then over time, of course, as we saw during the campaign of 2016, Mike Pence becomes a strong defender of now President Trump's plans for immigration.
And any fair-minded person looking at the president's action knows that what President Trump has done is essentially impose a pause on countries that have been compromised by terrorism.
But how do you think Mike Pence reconciles this personal experience of basically having his entire family owe its American story to an open immigration policy, or a somewhat open immigration policy, to the policies that he's now putting in place as vice president to Donald Trump, which explicitly ban immigration from so many countries and ban refugees?
I think Mike Pence would draw a line between threat of terrorism and no threat of terrorism. And in his mind, there was no threat of terrorism coming from an Irish immigrant in the 1920s, whereas there is a threat and a need to defend America against terrorism in the 2010s and 16s. I asked the vice president's office, would Mr. Trump's travel ban have applied to Richard Michael Cawley? And the answer came back that it would not apply because, quote, Ireland is not compromised by terrorism.
So I want to ask one question that I think listeners will wonder, given the moment that we're going through, where the White House has issued some executive orders that are making it harder for people from certain countries to enter the U.S. Is that something you guys think about, knowing the journey of your father, in your case, Nancy, or your grandfather, Gregory? Are you comfortable with that?
You know, that's a political question.
Sure.
And, you know, we're just here in Columbus, Indiana. We were minding our own business till my brother decided it was time to run for vice president. So we'll let it be at that.
And that's a brogue answer to that question.
Uh-huh.
And Gregory, I appreciate what you're saying. You and your mother are private citizens. I wonder if you think that people like your grandfather or your father may not have the exact same opportunity in America right now.
The way I feel about immigration right now is my father went through Ellis Island, mm-hmm, and had a sponsor. And I think that there should be more control over immigration, just as it always was. Mm-hmm. That is my personal opinion. I can only say how my father got here, and what was good for him is, I don't know what's good for people in this day and age. I mean, we're talking 60, 70 years ago. So it's a different world.
You know, the Irish are one of the strongest and most beautiful threads in our national fabric here in the United States.
So, Cheryl, it is St. Patrick's Day, and Mike Pence, who is so proud, as you've told us, of his Irish heritage, celebrated it in Washington with a breakfast at the vice presidential residence. Did he talk about his grandfather, and did he talk about immigration at that event?
While immigration was not mentioned at the breakfast, Richard Michael Cawley certainly was.
When Richard Michael Cawley stepped ashore at Ellis Island in 1923,
the Prime Minister gave the Vice President a school roster of his grandfather's elementary school class. He also brought with him an Irish census document showing the Cawley family from the 1911 census. And Mike Pence talked about the Cawley story and the bond with Ireland as really being enshrined in the Pence family heart.
Do you think that there were any politics surrounding that gift of the family history to the vice president, given what's going on?
The prime minister talked about 9/11, which I found very interesting. He talked about 9/11 and how so many of the first responders were Irish. The policemen, the firefighters were of Irish descent. And he looked at the vice president and he said, "I'm very glad to know that you have that emotional connection." So it was sort of a subtle and very diplomatic reminder to the vice president of, don't forget where you came from.
For centuries, the sons and daughters of Ireland have come here from across the Atlantic, and I say with a grateful heart and deep humility, I'm one of them.
Cheryl, thank you very, very much. I appreciate all the reporting you did, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Here's what else you need to know today. The leaders of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, two Republicans, two Democrats, are rejecting President Trump's claim that Barack Obama wiretapped his phone during the campaign. All of them say there is no evidence to support the claim. And
I'm actually an international student from India, New Delhi.
I came from South Korea.
From Sri Lanka.
Fewer international students are applying to American colleges, a drop-off many academic leaders are tracing to the immigration policies of President Trump. A new survey shows nearly 40% of U.S. universities are reporting declines in applications from foreign students. The biggest decline in applications is from the Middle East.
Kurdistan region of Iraq.
I'm from Hong Kong.
I'm from Iran.
I'm from Jordan.
And I'm from China.
The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Andy Mills, and Lisa Tobin. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Pedro Rosado, Andrew Phelps, Peter Sale, and Marcus Bagala. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday.